On April 18, 1943, Japanese Commander Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto left the Rabaul base in New Guinea for the Solomon Islands. It was Admiral's last flight. On his way to the island, 16 U.S. fighter jets appear in the sky and attack the Admiral. After the shooting, the plane wing falls apart and the Admiral's plane crashes in the woods. The question is, where did the planes come from? How was Yamamoto's direction revealed? As the Second World War was drawing to a close, Roosevelt died and his deputy, Harry Truman, assumed power. 4 months later, Truman issued an order for an atomic attack on Japan so the World War could end with the U.S. display of power. Truman was seeking power. The liberated lands were war booties, and in his opinion, peace was an opportunity for the next war. For the U.S., the Soviet Union was a hostile force. Yesterday's comrade became today's foe. In 1965, ARPA launched a project to create a real network. The technology was based on a theory by Paul Barron, breaking messages to smaller packages. After an extensive endeavor, finally, on October 29, 1969, efforts were made to link up the first two nodes and establish what was later named ARPANET. We typed the letter L and we asked, "Do you see the L?" They said yes. We typed O and asked, "Do you see the O?" And they said yes. Then we typed G and the system crashed. The first link between the California and Stanford universities was set up. It was a success. The network was invented. He said the complicated receivers and processors were secretly transferred in special diplomatic packages and bags to the embassies and were used for surveillance after being installed.
See that structure at the top that looks something like an Indian teepee with the little lightning rods on top? I watched them build that. I watched them construct it.
Duncan Campbell confirmed his claims. The tools in the U.S. embassies in Geneva and Berlin were of the same type. This part of Echelon was named the stateroom. Echelon services were improving by the day, and Mike Frost had more to reveal. As ordered by Margaret Thatcher, Echelon was used to spy on two UK cabinet members as well. Echelon's footprints could be traced in Princess Diana's death and the Mossad's revenge against the Munich incident. In 2000, James Woolsey, the CIA director, asserted that because of financial concerns, Echelon was involved in spying on industries and business as well. It led to big agreements by Boeing, which made European companies and experts lose jobs. The U.S. was stealing the Europeans' jobs as well.
That America was stealing European jobs.
A European delegation took a trip to Washington, but the U.S. canceled all meetings and the committee had to cut the trip short. The U.S. refused to answer the demands. On September 11th, 2001, something extraordinary happened. Two planes crash into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Everyone was speechless and emotional. No one saw the tower's engineered collapse. The Western media mobilized the international community. The perpetrators should have been arrested and executed. Because of such incidents, people would be under surveillance along with the terrorists. Everyone forgot how Echelon abused the circumstances. Echelon was unbelievably tasked with fighting terrorism. The war on terror started. After a while, the U.S. tried to form a coalition to launch an invasion on Iraq. Before that, Western officials considered Echelon's services meager and insignificant. But when Colin Powell sought to compel the U.S. Security Council members to launch an attack on Iraq by unveiling the conversation between Iraqi Ba'athist commanders about hiding chemical weapons, Echelon's unbelievable capabilities to record conversations came to light. The conversations could be converted into text. Echelon was higher than what was said. In 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq, which led to the massacre of people. Julian Assange made a disclosure. After founding WikiLeaks, he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. The number of whistleblowers gradually increased. On June 5, 2013, young engineer Edward Snowden, who worked in the intelligence company Booz Allen Hamilton as a security contractor of the Defense Department, in an interview made a huge revelation. The NSA had launched a large-scale surveillance program on everything, even social networks. The internet was not safe.
Targets the communications of everyone.
He proved that the security cooperation between Western countries amid the Cold War contained the most secret mysteries in the West. Protect America Act of 2007 led to the creation of a secret program, a program to gather two types of data, metadata and content from all conversations. The program was called PRISM. The conspiracy theory collapsed. There was a real plot going on. Google, which was the main research engine for many people to search, watch videos, and send emails, was at the heart of PRISM. All of the information and activities by users on the internet was recorded, and the NSA astonishingly had direct access to the data by Google and other internet giants like Facebook, Apple, Yahoo, and even small companies. It would easily save the data. The agency had worked a miracle. The coding software had become an agent of spying. For example, journalists used Tor software to hide their own identities. They were supposed to use Tor to not be tracked so their identities wouldn't be revealed, but that didn't happen. There was a big lie. Everything was right in front of the agency's organization. Only 10% of the internet was used by ordinary people, and the remaining 90% was being controlled by the NSA. Snowden disclosed facts about Bull Run and Q-Score. The programs were used for coding telecommunication and online data. They had a budget of $800 million. The situation was chaotic, and the issue was taken to the Senate. James Clapper was grilled in the Senate meeting. He was questioned if the NSA had recorded any information on U.S. citizens. Clapper said no. He was dismissed for wrong testimony. Things were even worse in Britain. Even though the UK intelligence agency had a system to identify coded telecommunication through cable networks, it was intensely after influencing Hotmail, Google, Yahoo, and Facebook. Their espionage program was Tempora, which started in 2008 and became operational in 2011. The other program was Edge Hill. These programs had unique features. They worked with advanced mathematical techniques. For example, Edge Hill, that cost $250 million a year, could crack emails, bank documents, and medical documents. It could penetrate VPNs and secure layers and was trying to penetrate 4G smartphones. This program would damage facilities on purpose. The software was really dangerous. Why were the facilities so vulnerable? According to U.S. laws, the companies were forced to send their products to the agency to test them for supervision. The NSA and the CIA would change the design and make the facilities sent by the companies traceable and would turn them into spy tools. The NSA was seeking to carry on with its surveillance activities through free hubs and Wi-Fis, just like GPS devices. Verizon wireless software with 100 million users was also used as spyware. The documents showed that the agency had penetrated international standards that stress coding systems and had caused weaknesses in security standards. Snowden struck the coup de grace on the concept of standards and information technology. The NSA influenced international standards that encryption systems relied on, working covertly in 2006 to get its own version of draft security standards issued by National Institute of Standards and Technology, the NIST, and approved for worldwide use. Standard was at the service of the NSA. It was as if everyone was trying to take over in the espionage race. The FBI and CIA were well aware of the weaknesses of smart systems, but they wouldn't say anything about it for espionage purposes. They were taking advantage of the vulnerabilities.
I feel terrible about what happened to these Iraqi detainees.
I'd do it again in a minute.
George Bush's operation to get revenge for the 9/11 attacks started with widespread espionage activities. The basis for the espionage was the internet. But it wasn't the whole plan to get revenge. The U.S. was thirsty for power.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The slogan, either you're with us or against us, led to the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. The ground was paved for international intranets. The coalition of eyes was formed. The information was classified and was provided only in a limited amount after receiving guarantees. The game had started. After a year, a 27-terabyte database was built in the Bagram Air Base data center that would save regional information. The Polish soldiers who were deployed in Afghanistan went to distant and tough terrains the U.S. troops wouldn't go. They received a tracking device in return for their favor and tried to help the U.S. more. But they weren't allowed to join the intelligence coalition in Afghanistan. Poland, along with several other NATO member states, was on the red list. The English-speaking countries that had historical and cultural roots in English islands had closer cooperation with each other compared to other countries, even in the occupation of Afghanistan. The coalition for Iraq was different. As they had to face a larger population, the agency rolled up its sleeves and simultaneously spied on 4 to 5 million Baghdad residents. The White House, the Defense Department, the FBI, and CIA had their own intranets. Gradually, it came to light that the number of the networks was much higher than already disclosed. Finally, top-secret intranets that could transfer sensitive SCI information were unveiled. Interlink and Intellipedia were special software for the agency staff to share information from all over the world. One of their favorite subjects was Iran's nuclear activities that led to the Stuxnet malware. The information also showed who was strongly against the invasion of Iraq and how different countries assessed their national information. In 2013, the CIA's budget to topple governments increased to $15 billion. The NSA, that was only assigned with digital operations, issued a bill of at least $10.5 billion. They claimed that their mission was to protect the United States' security.
Necessary to do the job to protect the American people from further attack.
The heavy investment on the NSA helped it become so advanced that in 2018, it could spy on all smartphones and completely control people and all cell phones. No phone was safe.
Are not especially good in protecting your privacy. Think right now.
What the NSA does has to do with encryption. It is the biggest employer of mathematicians in the world, either directly or indirectly. The NSA owns the biggest supercomputers in the world. The minimum amount of electricity bill in its headquarters in Maryland is $21 billion. The NSA supervises all processes of transfer of information in any shape or form. That is, an email sent from a room to the adjacent room is done under the watchful eyes of the NSA. Where does the NSA's power come from? Administratively, the NSA belongs to the Defense Department and works under the supervision of the DNI. The NSA's director is at the same time head of the Central Security Service as well. The NSA is an expert in signal intelligence and provides services to other intelligence agencies. The basis for the NSA's widespread activities are telecommunications and national security acts. The Telecommunications Act was ratified in 1996. The act stems from a 1934 act that's still binding. The president has the authority to control all communication in case of a threat posed by war. It means he can shut down the internet. But the internet is formed based on the activities of companies that provide internet services that are known as the internet's spinal cord. In 2010, U.S. senators claimed the right and ownership to the internet so they could shut it down as and when they wished. They put it to a vote to register the internet as a national asset. The motion was repealed without being put to a vote. The reason was the direct and indirect benefits of the internet for the U.S. The internet was a source of revenue and widespread espionage, so it couldn't be specific to a country. The U.S. economy was dependent on the internet, the NSA, and DARPA. In this economic model, the circumstances should lead everyone to anxiously use the internet. The internet was the attractive factor that facilitated other plans. It worked as a catalyst. On the one hand, shutting down the internet would cause concern in other countries and make them create their own national networks to transfer data. And making those facilities in other countries would reduce the possibility for espionage. So the national networks shouldn't have been created by other countries, and people shouldn't use them under the slogan of the internet for all, so intelligence agencies could carry out their operations well. The U.S. spy agencies came into being according to the National Security Act and spread like wildfire. Soon, there were 17 main agencies and many more departments. The intelligence spending in the U.S. is provided under two programs, the National Intelligence Program and the Military Intelligence Program. The spending for the two programs increased from $72 billion in 2013 to about $86 billion in 2020. The officials behind the two programs and all other institutions were called the U.S. Intelligence Community, or the IC. The IC considers itself a federation of its own constituents. It sets the goals and priorities. It spends billions of dollars for different intelligence projects. Some programs are introduced as a 10-year espionage program, and some others are for longer periods. The IC power increased after the 80s when analyzing data became a focal point, so it would help politicians by sifting through the information. In fact, it was discovering less expensive solutions to tackle America's problems. The information was fast increasing. Managing it was a tough challenge. The solution was investing on projects, the same policy that led to the creation of DARPA and advanced systems in the past decades. A project named Massive Digital Data Systems, the MDDS, was introduced. Universities were handed over control over the project. As IC demanded, Dr. Anita Jones, a scientist at the University of Virginia, became the director of DARPA. She had been on the board of directors at the Mitre firm since 1988, so she followed up on the project through Mitre. Huge finances were directly allocated to the best projects introduced. It gave a technological boost to Silicon Valley's tech companies. The most outstanding issue was a successful search engine to exactly find what they're looking for faster than other search engines. Professor Jeffrey Albin and his colleagues, who had previously worked with DARPA, referred two students to DARPA supervisors. They were really instrumental in ranking the pages, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Brin and Page started their work with the funding for the Digital Library Initiative, the DLI, a multi-agency program sponsored by the National Science Foundation, NASA, and DARPA. Two intelligence directors were in charge of directing the program, and as the search was progressing, they held regular meetings with Brin. The funding by the NSA and CIA were indirectly transferred to their bank accounts and other projects. In their article in 1988, which was published in the Bulletin of the Technical Committee of the American Compute Society on Data Engineering, Page and Brin described page ranking methods and stated that the article was sponsored by the American Science Foundation. The amount awarded by the foundation was over $4.5 million. After a while, they unveiled Google. No one knew how it was related to intelligence agencies. In September 1998, two technology entrepreneurs invested $100,000 on Google each.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A new study quantifies fossil fuel companies' impact on Western wildfires. The study, published in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Research Letters, is the first to quantify how corporate emissions have made wildfires worse. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. truth out road in this regard, the American West has always had forest fires, just not like this. Blazes are spreading further and burning longer, incinerating towns and exposing millions of people to noxious smoke, while a century of fire suppression and other land management choices contribute to the severity. Climate change is a key factor fueling these fires, roughly doubling the acreage burnt over the last 40 years. A new study takes this connection one step further, making the case that a significant chunk of burnt forest, nearly 20 million acres, can be traced back to major fossil fuel companies. The study published in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Research Letters recently is the first to quantify how corporate emissions have made wildfires worse. Experts say the new research could help advance growing efforts to take polluters to court. Carly Phillips, a co-author of the new study and a research scientist at the Science Hub for Climate Litigation at the Union of Concerned Scientists, said, "These companies should be held accountable for their fair share of the damages that they have caused. They lied and engaged in this orchestrated campaign of deception for years, and it didn't have to be this way, right?" Researchers from the Union of Concerned Scientists and the University of California, Merced, found that 37% of forests burnt across the western United States and southwestern Canada since 1986 can be linked to carbon pollution from 88 of the world's largest oil, gas, and coal companies. That group includes Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, and Shell. State-owned oil producers like Saudi Aramco and Gazprom, and cement manufacturers. Researchers considered emissions directly emitted by these companies' operations as well as the indirect emissions from the products they sold. Since 2017, cities and states have filed around 20 lawsuits against fossil fuel companies based on state laws that prohibit deceptive advertising seeking money to adapt to the effects of climate change. The suits were set in motion by investigations showing that Exxon, Shell, and coal companies had known about the dangers of skyrocketing carbon emissions for decades, but publicly downplayed the threat. After years of delays, the Supreme Court declined to get involved in these cases last month, clearing the way for them to proceed potentially to jury trials. This study comes as spring fires scorched western Canada during an unusually hot and dry spring, with about 1 million acres burning across the province of Alberta. An early heat wave pushed temperatures above 90 degrees in parts of the typically temperate Pacific Northwest, with Seattle and Portland breaking heat records at least 3 days in a row. The same heat dome is expected to fan the flames of nearly 90 fires burning across Alberta. It's hard to draw a direct line between global warming and wildfires, but recent advances in attribution science, the field that identifies climate change's role in heat waves, droughts, rising seas, and other phenomena, have made it possible to quantify its effect on fires. The new study relies on a key risk factor called the vapor pressure deficit, a measure of how thirsty the atmosphere is. Hotter temperatures cause moisture to be pulled out of vegetation, turning forests into tinderboxes just waiting for a spark. To figure out how companies' emissions contributed to fire danger conditions in the West, Researchers built on a previous study that linked emissions from 88 big fossil fuel producers to rising temperatures. Then they compared two models of how dry forests would be under different climate scenarios. One modeled on the real world and the other excluding the emissions associated with the 88 companies. The major contribution of this study is to connect all of the dots between specific sources of human-related carbon emissions and recent increases in forest fire activity, said Philip Higora, a professor of fire ecology at the University of Montana who was not involved in the study. Most of the links have been well known for a long time, but this is the first study to connect the dots quantitatively. Exxon and BP did not respond to Grice's request to comment in time for publication. Jessica Wentz, a fellow at Columbia University's Sabin Center for Climate Change Law, thought the findings could be used to support existing lawsuits or provide the impetus for other local governments or to file their own. Wentz said the research might be relevant to a case in Colorado, where the city and county of Boulder, along with San Miguel County, sued Sunker Energy and ExxonMobil, seeking millions of dollars to update their infrastructure to withstand climate change. Wentz said, "That's the one lawsuit where wildfire-related damages are forefront and central." Translating the research to a specific court case could prove thorny, though. The study looked at a large region, the whole North American West, and the aggregate of 88 companies' emissions. It's possible that attorneys could use the new research to calculate wildfire risk over a smaller area, say Boulder County, but it would require some extrapolation. For calculating damages, a court might want to see a more fine-grained analysis, Wentz said. It's really a totally open question of how courts will look at the evidence and just how granular will plaintiffs need to be in terms of providing scientific data to support their claims. We just don't know yet, he said. In a way, the long delays in these climate court cases have actually given some ammunition to cities and states looking to hold fossil fuel companies accountable. The extra time has allowed the science of climate attribution to mature, so that if these cases end up going to trials, cities and states have more evidence to support their case. It's a sort of weird silver lining, Wentz said.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Najat. Please stay tuned.
Uwais
al-Qarani, one of the companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, had a beautiful way of praying to Allah. He used to divide the nights of the week to different types of prayers. One night was called Laylatul Sujood. From early night up to early morning, he did all the prostration to Allah, saying, Subhana Rabbiyal A'la wa bihamdi. Yet another night was called Laylatul Ruku'. Over that night, he only recited Subhana Rabbiyal Azim wa bihamdi. Another night was called Laylatul Qunut. He used to recite and pray to Allah to be free from the fire of the hell. Uwais al-Qarani used to prostrate during the night in the dark deserts up to an extent that the birds thought he is a piece of stone. They went to his back and were playing there while he was still in prayer, without being distracted. This is how the true men of Allah pray. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Najat. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In a major political U-turn, U.S. President Joe Biden said on Friday, 19th of May, that he supports the delivery of advanced fighter jets to Ukraine, including F-16 fighter jets. Previously, the Biden administration was concerned that Kiev might use these jets to attack targets on Russian soil. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Military Watch magazine has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. may suffer serious logistical challenges by supplying Ukraine with advanced fighter jets, including F-16s, as there is a possibility that the fighter or its technologies could fall into Russian hands, or it could face significant losses in combat. Following months of Ukrainian government requests that Western countries supply it with F-16 fighter aircraft, President Joe Biden on Friday, 19th of May, said the U.S. will deliver Ukraine advanced fighter jets, including F-16s. The United States has come under growing pressure from its European allies to approve transfer of the aircraft to the Ukrainian Air Force. President Biden's announcement just came days after Britain and the Netherlands promised an international coalition to send Kiev the U.S.-made fighter jets it has long demanded. The Military Watch magazine writes, the F-16, although currently being replaced by the newer fifth-generation F-35, has for decades been the primary fighter fielded across much of NATO, as well as by key American allies beyond Europe, such as South Korea, and is considered the most suitable Western fighter for Ukraine. The military magazine says the looming depletion of Ukraine's ground-based air defenses, the West's very limited capacity to replenish these, and the growing influence of the Russian air power across the battlefield have all been factors stimulating Kiev's supporters to push to upgrade its air power with greater urgency. The Military Watch magazine revealed if F-16s are deployed to Ukraine, there is a possibility that the fighter jet or its technologies could fall into Russian hands, as other Western equipment has in considerable quantities. But there is also a much greater chance that the fighters could suffer significant losses, both to strikes on their airfields and in the air-to-air combat, which would be a major blow to the F-16's reputation. The Military Watch magazine says, a possible and key reason for the disagreement between the Europeans and the United States for sending F-16s to Ukraine is that the U.S. still has a very large stake in the F-16 program. The magazine adds, the fighter jets have been in service and continue to form the backbone of the U.S. Air Force for decades. Moreover, it continues to offer modernized variants of the class for export at times for hundreds of millions of dollars per airframe. So the United States is not willing to supply their older aircraft to the Ukrainian Air Force. The report says the United States has a great deal to lose from seeing its F-16s transferred to Ukraine, at a time when future orders for the class are already in question and the reputation of its air power is critical, particularly in theaters such as East Asia. The priorities of its European allies have often been very different. President Biden on Friday told leaders of the group of seven G7 countries gathered in Japan. He said Washington was prepared to help train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets donated to the former Soviet state. The United States gave the green light to its allies to supply Ukraine with F-16 fighter jets. Countries cannot resell or re-export American weapons and munitions without America's consent. In related news, Russia announced that its air defenses intercepted 12 HIMARS rockets and Storm Shadow cruise missiles over the past few days, as well as a US-made GBU-32 bomb supplied to Kiev by its Western backers. Russian Defense Ministry spokesman Lieutenant General Igor Konashenkov said air defense has intercepted 12 HIMARS rockets and Storm Shadow long-range cruise missiles in the past 24 hours, as well as a US-made GBU-32 guided munition. Lieutenant General Konashenkov said 18 Ukrainian drones were destroyed near Rakhnetrovsenko, Nova Andreyevsivka, and Sladkoye in the Donetsk People's Republic, and Kremenyaya, Poloshchanka, and Novodruzhetsk in the Lugansk People's Republic. Long-range attack drones were also added to the list of Western weapons supplied to the Ukrainian forces fighting against Russian troops. Russia's TASS news agency has also covered the same story. Russia has slammed the West's plan to supply the US-manufactured F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. Moscow on Saturday, 20th of May, warned the countries that are reportedly planning to supply F-16s to Ukraine, which is at war with Russia, of the colossal risk that this involves. In response to a question on the possible supply of American-made jets to Ukraine, Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said, "We see that Western countries are still adhering to the escalation scenario. It involves colossal risk for themselves." Alexander Grushko added, "In any case, this will be taken into account in all of our plans, and we have all the necessary means to achieve the goals that we have set for ourselves." The United States gave the green light to its ally to supply Ukraine with F-16 fighter jets, saying it is set to hold joint training courses for Ukrainian pilots to fly the aircraft. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has been requesting F-16s from the West, but has not yet won commitment to deliver the jets from any country, as no government has so far confirmed it will supply Kiev with warplanes, despite the push by the United States, Britain, and EU officials to send weapons to Kiev. In this regard, until now, Britain, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, and Canada have only all announced programs to give Ukrainian pilots training on F-16s. The shift in the US position has cleared the way for other Western nations to send their existing stocks of F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. Although it seems increasingly likely that Ukraine will eventually receive the advanced jets as it did the tanks and the air defense systems that were initially not given to Kiev. America's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters in Hiroshima, Japan, the Western alliance has so far focused on providing Ukraine with the system, weapons, and training it needs to conduct offensive operations this spring and summer. Jake Sullivan added, "As the training unfolds in the coming months, we will work with our allies to determine when planes will be delivered, who will deliver them, and how many."
Hidden Files.
Years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible, from misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions. The tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare. Not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in the show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years. And now, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists, they're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran, 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing you know, the good and the bad, and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S. to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s on a host of different nations like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism are people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions and often die as a result.
Well, let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice de Zayas. De Zayas is an expert for civil and political rights, and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He's been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University